You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. I just wanted to get a shot of on the video of Ryan sitting down in the shot. So he's like, dude, I'm not ready.
Dude,
back it up, man. Start over.
Shit.
Boy, hey, thanks. This is a special episode. We were going to take 2 weeks off, but I figured, you know, I don't want to lose an audience. And I love this this guest. If you haven't seen Shawshank Redemption and millions of other things. In fact, he was just in that show, The Crown. On Netflix, he played.
Yeah, he was LBJ.
LBJ.
Yeah.
He was great. He's great. Clancy Brown. Great. And I got to work with him on the Great Brain Robbery in the Justice League Unlimited years ago. We switched brains. He was Lex Luthor, ironically. Mm-hmm. And I was the Flash, of course. And it was fun. If you don't know anything about that, but you like Clancy Brown, well, you're here. So you're going to hopefully listen. I hope you guys have a brilliant freaking new year. And I just want to say thank you to everybody, Ryan, Bryce, all my lovely patrons. And everybody who listens to the show, you know, it's just the show's so important to me now. It's become a big part of my life just with, you know, talking about real stuff. And I hope that, you know, more people find it. And I hope that you guys stick around. And I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for sticking around and listening to episodes that with guests that you don't even know. And just because you might learn something. We all learn something. Ryan, what are the handles for Inside of You Podcast?
They are at Inside of You Pod on Twitter, at Inside of You Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, and YouTube.com/Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
YouTube.com/Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Yes.
That is awesome. Ryan edits the episodes so you can watch them. If you don't watch them, you should. And if you're watching, listen. Ooh, go listen. And I can't say it enough, but when you write reviews, if you really like an episode and it means something, you're like, you know, that was really good. You could take that minute to just write a review and also email your friends and say, please subscribe. It means the world and it really helps, believe it or not. It does. And I want to thank Westwood One for all their lovely support, all the ladies. I work with all ladies at Westwood One. Kelly and Teresa and Agnes and Kat and Katrin. And it's just a great group of people. And I like having all women in my life because they're really smart. They know what they're doing. And you just kind of let them do it. I defer to you, you know, women. But again, thank you to everyone and all the patrons out there who have really the reason why the show is still on its feet in the beginning. I mean, especially now, tough times and a tough year for everybody. But they stuck with me and they are so supportive. And even when I send merch boxes to them and I signed to the wrong person. Oops. And I have to, they're understanding. Very seldom do I get an email at hello@insideofyoupodcast.com. Hmm. Hello@insideofyoupodcast.com. That's right. Mm-hmm. Do I get a, you signed the wrong name? It's usually like, hey, this is from my dad for his birthday and his name's not Alicia. So I'm like, yeah, my bad, bro. My mind just goes, it's going south, man.
Unless dad realizes he's been Alicia the whole time.
There you go.
Digs deep.
That's why I have Ryan here, folks. Also, thank you everybody for coming to our Stage It. It was our biggest Stage It show ever. If you don't know Stage It, stageit.com, stageit.com. We do live shows every last Saturday of the month. Rob Danson and I, we're in a band. It's called Sunspin. It's just the two of us. We had the biggest turnout. And it was the day after Christmas. I thought no one was going to show up. And thanks to all our followers and everything, it was, you know, we've been able to make this album and it's coming out and the website's coming out soon. We just got the logo. We did a photo shoot, socially distanced. And we're just really pumped. It's in the mixing stage now. Then it's mastered and we should start releasing songs on iTunes. We'll have a pre-order for CDs. We're going to release a song probably every week once it comes out. And then the last week, two songs. And we're going to release it that way on iTunes and then have the album. We've got amazing merch. When the merch comes out, we've got like this collection lunchbox. So it's a lunchbox, but includes all the merch. But it's a Sunspin. It's black with yellow logo Sunspin. It's badass. So we're pumped. Look, I don't expect to be a rock star or anything like that, but I think we made some great music and I think you're going to like it. And I hope you share it with all your friends. Also, the Inside of You online store, it's on Shopify, but you go Inside of You online store. I'm going to put another discount code, 20% off for the for this coming of a new year here that's going to happen soon. And we got some great stuff. And I just put up some Lex Luthor pictures and Sorority Boys pictures and Justice League pictures and along with tumblers and hats and towels and a bunch of stuff. So there's great merch, and I'm going to try and clear it out to get new merch for the next year. So go to Inside of You online store, and then the discount code will be Rosenbaum loves you 20. Rosenbaum loves you 20. Y-A. All right, let's get into this wonderful guest. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy New Year, Ryan.
Happy New Year.
And I can't wait to hold you. We were just talking about taco night. I was starting taco nights here at my house, and Ryan's like, oh, I just saw an old email in March when you canceled the last.
It was sad. It was so sad. I was just searching through my email, and then, oh, God. Because it feels like it was years ago.
I just can't. Yeah, it does feel like years ago. I can't wait to have organized softball with my friends and taco nights. Will you come play softball with us?
Of course.
Yeah, you play.
Yeah.
You're good.
I'm very good.
Yeah. Wow.
That was... I got a rec league MVP on my shelf somewhere.
Yeah. All right. Let's get inside of a guy that I've worked with who's a legend. If you don't know him, he's got some great stories. He thought he was going to be boring. And I love you, Clance, and you're not boring ever. You're a genius, and it was an honor to interview you. Let's get inside of Clancy Brown.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
You're so technologically advanced. You're really advanced in technology, Clancy.
No, look at you. Like sitting behind the mic and got the camera and everything. You got your Barca lounger there, it looks like.
Yeah, I like to be comfortable. I'm naked from the waist down. That's how I roll. I gotta roll. You look comfortable now. Look, because I could relate in a way that, you know, when you play a villain or you play some bad characters, people are like, oh, he's great. And they start casting as the bad guy, right? We get typecast. I've been typecast as either the asshole or the killer or the transvestite for a while.
Yeah,
you know.
Those are always fun.
Yeah, but is there, I mean, obviously, I bet you go through stages, right? Because you're a seasoned actor. You've been doing this a long time. Was there a time where you're like, no, fuck that. I'm not doing the bad guy anymore. I'm doing this. Or did you kind of, was there a point you just said, I just want to work. I love working. What kind of attitude you have?
Well, I don't know. I've always loved working. But, you know, you kind of want to do stuff that you find interesting. So when you do a prison guard, and they keep asking you to do prison guards, it's like, come on, you know, I don't want to do a prison guard. You know, that's what they offer you. So if you need to make the dough, you go do the prison guard. If you don't need to make the dough and you don't mind auditioning, then you audition for something else, audition for the preacher. And then they decide that you're too, then they decide you're a preacher forever. That's happened a few times.
Well, let me ask you this. Didn't you ever feel like when your agent's like, hey, they got this role, listen, just hear me out, Clance. This is a prison guard. You're like, don't you ever want to say, there's not going to be a prison guard or a prison guard movie or a prison movie better than the one I did. No one's going to be, but nothing's better. Why would they want me as a prison guard in a movie that will never be as good as Shawshank Redemption?
And who knows, though, right? I mean, if it's a good part and it's a good script. That was such a great script. It was like, everybody was like, we'll do anything in it. And so it's such a good script, the Shawshank. But, you know, you never know. You read a good script and you fall in love with the script. You fall in love with the thing. And then you see, you know, maybe who's doing it and how expert they are and stuff like that.
So you're logical, Clancy. You're logical.
Logical. You try not to repeat yourself and you try not to, try not to jump to any conclusions, right?
Yeah. Well, look.
If you're lucky enough, you go sign up to do the thing you did before because, you know, you need to pay the kids' tuition or your mortgage or whatever.
That's right. That's right. That's true. You don't think of those things till later and you're like, you know, I could do this and it's easy and I've done this before. I know what they want. I'll go in. I'll do a good job. I'll try my best. I'll make some money and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Basically.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. So, well, we jumped into Shawshank because of the prison thing, but I rewatched it because I had to, because it's been a couple of years and it's one of the best movies ever made, period. I mean, is that something that they offered you or did you had to read for that?
Oh, I read for it. Yeah. Yeah. I read for it. It was one of the worst auditions I ever had, with Frank and the casting director. And, casting director was, a young lady, and she was dressed in a nice frilly floral blouse, and she smelled good, and she was done up, and and I had to scream at her, you know, you'll shit when I say you shit, and you'll piss when I say you piss. You got that, you mega dick mother. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I couldn't get it out, and I apologized to Frank at the end of it. I said, I'm sorry. You smell too good. I can't get this out. You know, I can't yell at you this way. You're a nice young lady. I couldn't do it. So I left there thinking, I'm never going to be in this movie. It's too bad. It's such a good script, and I'll never be in
it. So what happened?
So they called up and they offered it to me. They said, yeah, no, you'll be all right. You'll be good. And on the flight out, I mean, I was convinced they had made a mistake. They thought I was somebody else, and they shot it in Mansfield, Ohio. So we're flying into Columbus or wherever we're flying into, which is a flight I've taken before because that's where I'm from. And I'm sitting there, and back in the day when they flew you first class, I'm sitting there in first class, and I see all these actors roll in, you know, all these really good actors, Dave Proval and Joe Ranio and just everybody that's there, Gunton, and I see Bill Sadler, and I'm like, oh damn, that's who they think I am. They think I'm Bill Sadler, and he's going to be playing my role. And so I just really, the whole flight, I was just like in the window seat. It's like, this is going to be so embarrassing when I get there and they tell me that they're going to send me home. I was absolutely convinced.
Hang on. You're on this whole 3-4-5 hour flight. You swear to God, this is really what you're thinking. You're thinking they got the wrong guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, not until we sat down and we read this, we had a read through. I was convinced. I mean, you know, they had Mark Ralston and Sadler. And I mean, they had like all these great actors. Brian Libby and I mean, you know, I'm trying to come up with everybody's name now, but you know, they're all guys that I recognize, and they're all character actors, and they're all terrific. And I'm sitting there going, this is not who they think I'm, somebody else.
Are you intimidated?
I wouldn't say I was intimidated. I knew I gave a bad audition.
I've had those. The worst case scenarios, people always say, I want offers. I like offers. But when you get an offer and then you go in and then they're like, no, that's not what we want. But if you audition for something and they like what you did, then you do that most of the time.
Right.
So you go in there and you do something that you're like, well, fuck, I barely even got anything out. I don't even know why I'm here.
Yeah.
And then you get there, and then like, what's your first day like? What's your first day as an actor going, I shouldn't even be here?
No, we went up for rehearsal back when they would actually rehearse, right? So we sat down and we had a read through, and there's Morgan and Tim and, you know, all the guys and Gunton and whatnot. And we have the read through, and it says, you know, on your little thing, it says Clancy Brown, Captain Hadley. So that's like when the first time I thought, okay, they that's when I sit down, they'll realize that they think somebody else is Clancy Brown, you know. We started reading it and nobody seemed to blink an eye, and it was the most intense imposter syndrome I've ever had, was that movie.
Jesus.
And then once we started going, it was fine, you know, it was okay.
I mean, I watched that scene on the rooftop. Like, you're so intense that even years later, I've seen this movie, everyone's seen it, and then you watch it again, I really think you're going to throw Tim Robbins off the roof. I really feel like you're losing your shit, but it's this contained fucking just pure innate disdain for this man or any of these people around you. And I'm like, it's such a powerful character, and you're thinking, oh my God, prison's really hard. I bet they were like this. And
prison sucks. Yeah.
I mean,
sucks.
God. I mean,
and he's stupid. He's a stupid, stupid man. I mean, he's just such a dumb man. It's like, those are the people that you're afraid of most.
Oh, yeah.
In authority that are so deeply ignorant that they do stuff like throw people off roofs. I mean, they're just, what is wrong with that guy?
Isn't that the truth, though? Well, there are people like that around us that are just, you're like, wow, they just don't see what we see. And you hate to think, well, what I say is right. But then you're saying, well, this is just the right way, though. Am I missing something here? How does this guy think the opposite of what I think so far? But that's the way it is. You know what pisses me off is you've played Lex Luthor longer than any other Lex Luthor, including me. You know that?
That's an accident. But no. You played him more consistently. I'll bet you actually have more hours of playing Lex Luthor. I mean, if we actually added up the time. What about Cryer? How many episodes did he do?
Cryer, I think he's in the second season.
Oh, okay.
So he's way behind. He's got time.
No, you win. We all know who Lex Luthor is.
No. People really, I'm telling you, you have a following, man. You have a following and people love
you. It's a cartoon.
But it doesn't matter. I've said that before and people are insulted when I say, well, it's animation when I do this. No. That role means as much as live action to many people.
I understand that because that's sort of the world that Superman was created in.
Right.
But the live action adaptations, they're hard to do. And Smallville was the best of them.
Oh, come on.
Smallville was definitely the best of them. Lois and Clark was kind of fun for a minute, you know, because everybody was young and good looking. But it became a soap opera and nobody really cared after a while. But Smallville was like the right show at the right time, really realized real well. I think Smallville is just kind of genius.
I didn't even know you watched it.
Yeah, I saw a couple of episodes, sure.
Well,
I'm not really the demo for it, but you know.
You're not that much older than I am. How old are you?
I'm old. I'm 61. 60. What is the 20? Yeah, 20. 20, I'm 61.
That's not old.
59.
How many times have you thought to yourself, Clancy, I'm old? And then you go, what was I thinking 10 years ago? I wasn't old.
No, dude. But with this COVID thing, I've like crossed into the at-risk demo. I don't feel at risk.
Well, why are you at risk? Do you have pre-existing?
No. Because I'm 60 plus, right?
And that's what they say, 60 plus. But you feel healthy. You look good.
Thank you. So do you, my man.
Well, thanks, man. I got this thing. If you notice this big thing on my face, it's not a fight. I'm not that tough, but it was just a little pre-cancer thing they burned off. No big deal. I always feel like I need to say, you know, when you have something on your face, you got to go, oh, this is that. Or if,
oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, you know what I mean?
You had a little skin cancer?
Yeah. Have you ever dealt with any of that stuff?
No, not yet.
Knock on wood. Knock on, you know, wood around you?
Knock on wood. It's us. It's the fate of us fair-haired people. It's fair.
Yeah.
Fair people.
Although I've been bitching at my dad for I don't know how many years. He's 68 and he's, you know, balding and he just has moles and he never wears sun protection and he bathes in the sun and he's never had skin cancer, knock on wood, anything. And I'm like, I'm always telling him. And then who gets skin cancer? This right. Asshole.
Where does he live?
He lives in New York. Well, he just got a place in the Caribbean. He got this little apartment.
Then he's going to be in danger. He's got to use sunscreen down there, man, because it's about being exposed to the sun. Yeah. In New York, you know, he's walking around the buildings. There's no sun in New York.
That's true. That's very true. You know what amazes me? It's Hollywood, and you look at all the divorces and all the shit, and I look and I'm like, you're married to the same woman since 90 freaking 3.
Yeah, I'm lazy.
Is that what
I'm
it
totally
is?
Lazy. Yeah, I'm just a lazy old man. We actually got married the day after we shot that roof scene in Shawshank, I took off and went to Chicago and then got married the next day and then brought my bride back and to Mansfield, Ohio for the honeymoon and to finish filming.
And by the way, are you one of those actors who kind of gets into the role where you're sort of like an asshole off camera until the role's over? Are you method?
No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe I am.
I'm going to ask your wife. I'm interviewing your wife after this.
My wife. Yeah.
No. Does she read lines with you ever?
No, I do wrangle my kids sometimes to do that.
Really?
But not my wife, yeah.
Well, who ran lines with you for like a Shawshank movie or Highlander or any of these movies?
Well, let's see. At Shawshank, I rented a house with Larry Brandenburg, who played Skeet. And we rented this farmhouse. He's from rural Minnesota, and I'm from rural Ohio. So we were quite comfortable there in Mansfield, outside Mansfield. We rented a house outside Loudonville. And so we were just hanging out watching satellite TV when satellite TV was a big freaking satellite.
Oh, yeah.
Big box and all that stuff on your desk. So we were just hanging out right there. And then I brought my bride back and he FO'd for a week or so.
So you can make sweet, hot, newly married love.
That's right, baby.
The days when you used to make love.
In the cornfields, you know.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Hey, are you one of those guys that the director wants you to just go bigger and bigger and bigger, or they have to bring you down?
Depends. I appreciate that direction. Like, go bigger, bring it down, you know, whatever. The story I tell of Shawshank is that Frank gave me one of my favorite directions of all time, which we had a group of guys there that were really better than their roles. You know, any one of those guys could have been should have been leading their own TV show. They're all very good, but because of the script was so good, we all wanted to do it. So we were always thinking up stuff to steal screen time with, right? We were always thinking up stuff to fill out our characters and to you know, make more noise for ourselves on camera. And I was no exception. And there was one shot where I'm walking across the yard and I decided, okay, my guy is, his brain is rotting because he's so dumb and he's getting his Tourette's. And so he just starts swearing for no reason. And so I'm walking across the thing and I'm just swearing to myself. And yeah, I can't even remember what I made up, but I made up some silly stuff that just had no relation to anything, just total non sequiturs. And I'm walking across there and we're rolling. And, you know, it's a big shot that they're setting up and you know, big cranes and lots of extras and shit. And I'm doing it. And we rehearse it one time, rehearse it a couple times. And I'm working out what I'm going to say. And finally we roll and I do it. And then, you know, everything stops and they say, "Hey, Clance, just a second. Frank's going to come down and give you some notes." And Frank like climbs off the top of the roof and off the crane. And he comes down, he puts his arm around me and walks down. He's got his little cigarette and walking along. And he says, "You know, that thing that you're doing, that swearing, that sort of Tourette's-y thing that you're doing as you're walking." I said, "Yeah, man, how about that? Huh? It's pretty good, right? Good little action. I think the character is okay." He says, "No, no, no, don't do that. It looks stupid."
So he couldn't tell you that. He couldn't tell you that from afar and say, "Hey, just don't talk."
Yeah, but how great that he didn't embarrass me that way, right? I mean, you know, he like climbed down and he put his arm around me and he said, "Don't do that. It really looks stupid." I love you, Frank. You can direct me doing anything.
Who was the most fun working with on that project? I mean, everybody around you, it seemed like everybody was great.
Yeah, we all had fun. Yeah, that was when we first started. When was it? It was we worked from was it Labor Day? No, it wasn't Labor Day. We worked until Labor Day. We worked like from July 4th to Labor Day. And anyway, there was basketball playoffs going on, and it was during 93 or something.
Was that the Knicks?
Yeah, Knicks and Bulls were playing. So you had a bunch of guys from Chicago and you had a bunch of guys from New York in the cast.
Right.
And so we'd all go down to, you know, the local, you know, Buffalo Wild Wings or whatever they had there. And we'd watch the game. And that was our social life. So, but, you know, we were all having fun. We were all figuring out. There was a couple of restaurants in Mansfield, Ohio. We all got a kick out of the fact that it was voted in one of these magazines as one of the worst cities in the United States because of the poverty and the crime and stuff. But we never really experienced that. They were all really great to us. And
yeah. How tall are you?
6'3". How tall are you?
I'm 6 on the dot. You know, a lot of people will say
you're
that.
You're a shorter Lex Luthor.
I'm a shorter Lex Luthor, for sure. Do you think people, since you're like a big guy, you look intimidating, you look like you can kick someone's ass, maybe you probably can. Do you think people at a young age, were you always tall? Did you get picked on at a young age, or did you get it to a certain age where people started messing with you because you were bigger, or what did you go through as a kid?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. I didn't really get into my body until I was in high school and college. You know, I guess I got a little bit of every reaction.
Were you popular? Popular? Were you popular?
Was I popular? Popular? I never perceived it that way. Although I ran into a guy who was a couple years behind me in high school, and his daughter was, he was also looking for a place to send his daughter to high school. And so we, you know, renewed our acquaintance. When I knew him, he was kind of small, kind of a, you know, maybe 100 pounds soaking wet. And I was a senior in high school, and when I met him, he was bigger than me. He was 6'5". He was, you know, 200 pounds, and smart as a whip, like he always was. And you know, he said, "Oh, you were the dude in high school. You know, you were the one everybody looked up to." And I never perceived that when I was in high school.
Really, you never saw that in yourself?
Nah, hell no.
Now, was it because you were humble, or were you a nervous kid? Were you an anxious kid? Anything like that?
No, I wouldn't say necessarily. I mean, kind of dumb.
Come on, you're not dumb.
Kind of a dumb kid.
I don't believe that. See, that's what I always said about myself, and I'm stopping. You know, I try to stop myself from saying that, but I was like, I wasn't very smart. My dad, you know, he was always really smart, and I think he was just like, shit, I got a dumb kid, and. You know, that's it. And it's just like not, I'm telling you, for a long time, I felt all those things. And then I was like, wait a minute, you weren't dumb. And then, you know, through therapy, they're like, well, don't you learn all these lines? Don't you do this? Do you think dumb people, that's what they could do? So you start that's to, right. So you don't honestly believe you're dumb back then or not now.
I mean, you know, back then, all you're doing is comparing yourself to those around you, right?
Yeah,
there were better athletes. There were smarter kids. There were, you know, I was never the smartest, and I was never the best athlete. And so, you know, you don't think that you're anything special.
That's the way of looking at it. Were your parents like, "I love you, Clance. I love you. I'll always love you. I'm rooting for you. You're a smart kid. You're a great athlete." Or were they kind of like, "I don't give a shit"?
No, you know, it was the 70s. My parents were busy with other stuff. You know. They were busy with other things. They, you know, my mom and dad always say to me, "You are such a better parent than we ever were."
Why do they say that? Because you're more attentive, you're more present.
No, it's just it's just a different time. You know, we were in D.C. and my dad was in Congress, and they had important stuff to do and think about, and they didn't really pay that much attention to their kids. You know, it was a different time. You didn't have to be a helicopter parent back in the day. They were, you know, involved with the school and on the parent council and, you know, all that other crap. But, you know, they didn't really monitor me or anything.
Right. But they were supportive, right? They said, "Clancy, I'm proud of you."
Yeah. They came to the shows and the games, you know.
The shows. When was the first show? When did you start, like, I'm going to be an actor? When was that moment?
Oh, well, I don't know. You know, after college, I just thought I'd give it a shot. You know, I always liked doing it.
And they supported that.
I did it. Yeah, yeah. I did it in high school and college and stuff. They didn't come out to the college shows so much, but they did, you know, they came to the high school shows and all that stuff.
I mean, yeah. Well, were they like at the end of a show? Was your dad? Was he like, "You know, Clancy, you're a pretty damn good actor. That was pretty good." Nope, didn't get that.
No, they were supportive. I mean, my dad was particularly supportive. He just said, "Look, you know, I work hard to give my kids the opportunity to do whatever they want. So if you want to go try this, that's fine."
That's nice, though.
That was after college. My mom was not that way. She was like, you know, your dad worked hard to give you, you know, this opportunity of the family business or this opportunity to go into politics, and you're throwing it all away to go be an actor. And I was like, hey, that's not what dad said.
Right. Because there was a newspaper in your family, like people, they ran a newspaper. There was a congressman. Your dad a congressman?
Yeah, congressman. Yeah.
So you had all these things, these aspirations as a congressman, run a newspaper, do it. I'm going to be an actor.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. But you know what? It's what my dad said. He's like, you know, yeah, this is what I did. This is what I do. You know, I followed in my father's footsteps. My father, you know, my father says, you know, my grandfather was a congressman and he ran newspapers and stuff. But he said, there's no reason why you have to do that. You know, you should go do what you want to do. That's why, you know, parents do what they do, is to give you the opportunity to do it. Now, I, you know, did he think it was going to work out? I'm sure he didn't.
How could he?
That's not something parents think is going to work out. You know, I promised him that I would just try it for a few years and then, you know, go to grad school or whatever.
Well, what was the first time that you're like, ah, I got him? They're really proud. I could tell they're proud. You did something. Something clicked where they're like, oh, he's successful. This is happening.
I don't know. I think, you know, when they, it's with every parent, is when your kid is praised by someone else to you, you know, like when somebody says, you know, but I wasn't there for that. You know, when I hear that my daughter is a brilliant director, then I'm so proud of her. You know, those are the great times. That's when the worry goes away. I'm sure that's what happened with my folks, is that, you know, one of their friends said, I saw your son in this and it was really good. Maybe Shawshank, they thought that was it. But, you know, I don't know. I was also getting married then, so that probably wasn't the first thing I know.
Right. They wanted you to get married. That's what.
It's like, when are you going to get married?
Yeah.
When are you going to get married?
Always. Why is that? My grandmother, still, she's 92. She's like, when are you going to, you'd be such a good dad. Why don't you want to do this? I'm like, first of all, you're 92. How long am I going to have a kid for you so you can see him for 2 years? You know, you're 92. I have to live with this woman for the rest of my life. I have to have this child and take care of it. I go, well, my grandma told me to do it, but she's dead now.
You should have a child. You would be a good dad.
How does it change your life? How does it change your life, honestly?
It makes you, well, you know, okay, we're actors, so we spend a lot of time inside our own heads and worrying about, worrying about our auditions, worrying about our how we present to the world and how we present to maybe a specific person or a specific thing. And suddenly you have to get out of that and you have to take care of something so that it doesn't die. You have to make sure something in your life doesn't die while you're responsible for it. And so that just kind of changes your life there for a minute. You have to stop thinking about yourself.
That's terrifying too, at the same time.
Yeah, sure it is. Sure it is. But I mean, here's the other thing, like, you know, less fortunate, less privileged, less, you know, less intelligent people have done it just fine for many generations, right?
Is that what you kept telling yourself?
Less comfortable people have gotten by just fine.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
I mean, I envy people like you because I look at you and you go, I'm sure you'll sit here and say, you're wrong. I'm not. but you seem just together. You've always been sort of like, you don't really care about the limelight. You don't, you're kind of a private guy. You're just, you know, you like acting, you love your family, and that's it. Is that pretty right on?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even again,
yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I think that you're just, your whole disposition, the way you handle yourself, you can handle these things that come at you. But I wonder, my question is, in the beginning, did you feel that anxiety? Did you feel like, oh my God, I have a kid. What am I going to do? I'm going to fail. It's going to be my fault. Did you ever go through any of that shit?
Yeah. I mean, you know, with the kid, you suddenly have to think about things you never had to think about before. You know, I mean, you suddenly have to think, you know, I got to keep a roof over this head. I got to make this mortgage. I mean, that's sort of when I started. It's sort of when I started doing everything. The blessing was, it's when I started doing voiceover, right? And that was just a revelation. That was so much fun. And so I'm so glad that that happened. But I did that kind of to stay in town, not to solve any of my problems. I just did it because I wanted to. I didn't want to have to leave town to work, which is where I always had to go. But it was always, you know, I was always nervous about keeping the roof over the head and doing that. And, you know, balancing that with being present, I wanted to be present as well. There was a period when I was like probably overcharging for my services that took a little while for me to realize that, wait a minute, they don't do that anymore. They don't overpay for actors anymore.
Yeah, they certainly don't.
Right when the corporations decided that top of show is the minimum.
Right. Yeah.
So, and your quotes don't matter and all the rest of that stuff. So I think I hit a high quote right when my daughter was born, right after Shawshank, you know. And, I think that was my highest quote. And then after that, it was, you know, a couple years of not getting paid that and realizing, okay, I have to work for less.
You know, what was the, you know, obviously people always come up to me and they're like, oh my God, Clancy Brown, when you guys switched minds and
That was a good one.
The Great Brain Robbery.
That was a good episode.
I don't think I ever really worked with you. And all of a sudden you're sitting there with me. And we're just going back and forth, and you're like, say your line, and then you'd say it like me, but in your way. You know what I mean?
Oh, it was so fun. It was so fun.
It was. I remember us laughing, going, "What the?" It was kind of confusing. It was in a way, but it was really fun. And having Andrea Romano, who we both adore, right?
Right.
Directing us, yeah.
But you know how fun is that too? That they wrote it, and who wrote that one? By the way, do you remember?
I don't remember who wrote that one.
Yeah,
it wasn't Bruce? I have to look that up.
Great writers they had.
Yeah.
But, you know, how fun that they took those characters and decided to do that and let us do that. You know, we're looking for a way to, knew that we would like it, knew that we could pull it off and have so much fun doing it.
Yeah.
Because they could have done it with anybody. They could have done it with any bad guy and any superhero. But, you know, I take that as a big compliment.
It was. I was playing Lex Luthor on Smallville. You were the voice of Lex. I was voicing the Flash in the Justice League. And then right. we switch. And it was just awesome. It was great. It was really great. You know, you've worked with so many people. What's the most fun you've had besides obviously working with me, but like big actors? Like, what's the one guy actor like, wow, he's doing voiceovers too? Because a lot of big, big actors do them.
Right. I've not found that that people that are well known for film and television, that they're actually that good. I think probably the people we had in Justice League were the most versatile of that crew that crossed platforms easily. You know, you and Lumley and
those guys, yeah.
Maria and
Susan, George, yeah.
But what I've usually found with stunt casting is that they're not that good. You know, they're a little intimidated by the technology, intimidated by the process of it. And they're not good at it.
But you know what it is? They don't let go as much. And they just,
I
think when you're doing it, I found that the more I just said, fuck it, and just let go. And Andrew said, do another one like this. You just do it. Don't worry about looking like an idiot. Just do it. It's just the voice. We just have to get something, no matter how you get there. And I definitely could tell when I was working with bigger actors, you know, that they just hadn't done it and that wasn't their passion. Right. And, you know, they're like, and so it was harder to get out of them. You'd assume.
Right. It's just they're not used to doing it. That's really what it is. Not that they're not good at it. It's just that they're not familiar with doing it. The guy that that was really good at it from the get-go was a guy that I got in to SpongeBob, Dennis Quaid. And I had just worked with Dennis on a movie. I can't remember which one.
Not Dreamscape.
No. I'd worked with him on a couple of things. It was one called The Express and one called At Any Price. It must have been after The Express. And I said to I think it was Andrea that was actually doing SpongeBob at that point. And I said to Andrea, I said, we got to get Dennis in here because all he does is his version of Mr. Krabs all the time. All he's doing, he just loves to, you know, be Mr. Krabs in front of me. And we, you know,
so wait a minute. Dennis like Quaid that. Impersonates you from Shawshank.
No. He impersonates me doing Mr. Krabs.
I'm Mr. Krabs. Right. So is he dead on?
No, he sounds like Dennis doing Mr. Krabs. So they thought up the episode, Grandpappy the Pirate. And so Mr. Krabs' grandpappy was coming into town and Mr. Krabs had to put on a show that he was a pirate, that, you know, the Krusty Krab was actually a pirate ship and not a, you know, he was following in his footsteps. And so he put on this fake show and the boys were my crew and all the rest of that stuff. And Dennis came in and just knocked it out of the park, man. He was having so much fun. And he brought in his son and he was just like, hey, he was just all over the place.
Wow.
He came in and nailed it. He's a pretty free spirit. That
do you still talk to Dennis?
He gets going. Not as much as I'd like to. I like him so much. He's a good guy. You?
I don't know him. I've never met him, but I've always loved him. I always loved his work. It was like him and Michael Keaton in the 80s. I love those guys. They just had an energy to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, now he's doing that commercial now.
I just don't get it. But you know what?
I'm sure it's commercial.
It's just odd. It's just odd. I just...
Dennis Quaid.
Yeah, it's just, it's like that. And look, I respect people want to make money. They get to do whatever. It was just an odd commercial. You know, it's like that one, what's his name? Tom Selleck. He's humble, but it's 5 minutes long.
Well, that one's a little long.
I changed the channel. Yeah. I come back after lunch. It's still going on. I don't know what the hell it is.
It's
but, you know,
infomercial.
Yeah, it's an infomercial. Yeah, but how do they air infomercials all day?
You got to get that money out of the old people. We got to.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, got to get money out of old people.
Do you think you'll be the kind of actor? Do you feel like are you one that just loves acting so much that you'll work until you die, or you'll retire one day and say, "Fuck it, I'm done"?
I'll retire one day. Yeah.
You just won't want to do anything.
No, I mean, you know, but we got this voiceover gig, man. We can always do something.
You know, obviously, you just did this movie, Mortuary Collection, the Mortuary Collection. Now, look, I love horror movies. Okay, I'm a big horror movie fanatic. And this is a poster. You're the cover. You're the guy. You're the mortuary collector.
Me and Caitlin, yeah.
Right, you and
I'm
Caitlin.
I'm the mortician.
You're the mortician. Now, look, I love horror movies. And right now, I mean, look, I probably watch one a day. I have Shudder account, which...
Oh, good.
Which,
yeah, good.
Mortuary That's, Collection.
It premieres on Shudder.
And by the way, it premieres on Shudder, and I love Shudder just because it's $5.99 a month, and I have just 1,000 movies to choose from. Of course, I'm going to choose the Mortuary Collection. By the way, Spindel, Ryan Spindel directed it.
Yeah, you're going to love it. I mean,
I already watched it.
Oh, did you see
they
it?
They sent me
a
link.
Did see it.
I love the way it's shot. I love the creepiness of all. I love those angles, and I love the end, the twist. Look, I don't want to give anything away, but like, I just love how usually these write-ups, these log lines are usually shit. But this is a good log line. Usually it's like,
okay,
two brothers kill their parents. Okay, well, he told the story. This is on the cusp of retirement. An eccentric mortician recounts several of this strangest stories he's encountered in his long career. Things take a turn for the phantasmagorical when he learns that the final story is his own. Mortuary Collection.
And it's not completely accurate.
Well,
you know,
but
retirement?
It's pretty...
Is it retirement?
Well,
is that what happens?
Well, there's the twist. There's the, you find out that it's not really as retirement as, I don't want to give it away. Fate, let's say fate. No,
right.
But
it's a good. Ryan is. You know, he's a born storyteller. And he loves the medium, and he knows his way around a set and a camera, and you know, he's a talent. He's a real talent. I compare him to, like, you know, young Spielberg, young J.J. Abrams type. He's like in that mold where he's, yeah, you know, he knows.
Well, it creates a unique world, an inviting, yeah, kind of scary world. Like a fun,
yeah,
scary.
You can, like, think it up and put it on screen, and whatever problem comes up, he can work around and solve and make it conform to his vision. And his vision is terrific. His vision is real specific and real detailed. And it took 2 years to make that thing, and longer than that if you count the short that he did before, which is called The Babysitter Murder,
right?
Which was the kind of the proof of concept thing that he made. And so it's, you know, I guess you could say it's been 7 years. Everybody has these long periods, but he said, look, you know, we couldn't make it quickly for the amount of money that they wanted to do it. What we had to do was make it well, slowly, you know. We had to do it the way we wanted to do it, but that meant we had to take our time. You know, and they had to stretch the dollars through this 2 year period. And so, you know, he's good at it. And he didn't compromise that much, you know. He knew where to compromise that it wouldn't look bad.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous.
It really is. I was surprised by how beautiful. Well it looked. This is right. It's cinematic. It's absolutely cinematic when you, yeah, watch it. And the angles on your face, I'm like thinking of all the prosthetics. Like, what the hell was he? Did they CGI his face? Because it was practicals, right? It was prosthetics.
Yeah.
How many hours were you in, yeah, the makeup trailer?
Not too many. I mean, we had one. Mo Meinhardt was the key there. It was about 3 hours, I would say, and it would have been faster if she had a partner. And every now and then we could. There was another. Makeup artist that would assist her, but that makeup artist was also responsible for everybody else. So,
right,
you know, a lot of times it was just Mo. So, like, you know, it would range from like 2.5 to 3.5 hours.
You got cranky. Come on, admit it. You'd get cranky. You had to have done.
No, I didn't, not with her. Not at all.
Not with her. After 3 hours in the makeup.
You look her up on IMDb. She's gorgeous. She's beautiful. She's funny. And I know the drill, and she knows the drill. And
are you trying to hook me up with your makeup artist? Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Hey, let me ask you. Look, I mean, you do so many fun things. I look at all the projects with the animation. You got a happy family. I mean, you could be lying. It could be miserable there. It could be just like hell at your house. But, you know, life's good for you. You're not old. You're 61. You make it sound like you're old. You're not. I'll tell you right now. Yeah, definitely not. Dude, but you also like have legendary roles like Highlander, which I know you talk about ad nauseum, and like Starship Troopers. And like, I mean, these movies, when you do them, I mean, obviously when you're working with Sean Connery and Highlander, you're like, Sean Connery is in this, going to be a big movie, right? You thought that.
Yeah, that movie is a complete accident. I don't know if you know anything about that movie.
I don't.
But the guy that wrote it, Greg Wyden, he was a college kid. I think he was an undergrad, you know, at USC or UCLA or wherever the hell he was. And that was his, he wrote this script as his final for some cinema script writing class that he did. And then these buzzards, these scavengers, that were the producers, these two guys I won't mention their names. They sort of like, pick over these things, and they go in and they snag a script that's, you know, maybe won an award or you know, got an A or whatever it is, and they pay the guy, you know, $500. Here's $500 for your script. Yeah. And then they go and they pitch it to the wherever they had the deal, and And I think they said they would pay, you know, they paid him a couple thousand bucks and a portion of the budget if a percentage of the budget if it gets picked up and made.
And this became so Highlander.
And they're low budget guys. So they, you know, they're thinking they're gonna pay him maybe another 10 grand or something. So then as these producers do, they just go out to big stars anyway, you know, they expecting to get turned down. And so they went to Sean Connery and said, hey, we want you to play the Highlander. I don't even think they even read the script. They just said, you know, Highlander, that's a Scottishman. So let's go to the big Scottish, Scott movie star. So they sent it to him and he said, no, I'm not interested in doing that, but I would be interested in playing Ramirez. And so suddenly they had interest from Sean Connery and the budget goes up. And then they said, well, if we can get him to play Ramirez, let's get somebody to, who are we going to get to play the Highlander? And they, you know, they start casting around. Somebody says, well, you know, you should send it out to this young French actor who just won the César for his role in Subway. And, you know, he's a big European star. So they sent it out to Christoph and he said, oh, Sean Connery's in it. I'll do it. So then they had the big European star, the biggest European star at the time.
So the budget goes up.
The budget goes up again. And so then they go out to Arnold Schwarzenegger because he had just done Terminator. And they said, we're going to get Arnold Schwarzenegger. And the budget's going to go up again. And Arnold Schwarzenegger said, I don't want to play a bad guy again. I don't want to play a bad guy. I want to play.
So the budget goes down.
They're like, oh, no, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And the director, they got a director out of Australia who had basically made his bones doing music videos, named Russell Mulcahy, although he had directed a really terrific horror movie called Razorback, which is kind of like Jaws in the Outback in Australia. And they got him for probably not much money, but really talented guy. And so Russell was like hanging out with his music video friends and he was talking to Sting and they're like, we went out to, I don't know who we're going to get. We went out to Schwarzenegger. He turned it down and Sting said, well, I just worked with this big American bloke named Clancy Brown on this movie called The Bride. You know, he seems like a pretty good actor. He seems like a pretty good guy. Why don't you check out him? So I met with he calls up the producer, said, check out this other guy, this Clancy Brown guy. And I met with those guys. I'm like, I think it's a great story. I would love to play it. But, you know, how much are you going to pay me? And they don't pay me. They don't want to pay me anything. And I don't have a quote or anything, but much of anything. So they pay me nothing. And they're thrilled because they pay me nothing. They get their movie made. And we go and we make the movie. And Greg is, you know, he's this kid out of college who wrote this thing and suddenly he's a millionaire because he gets a percentage of a real budget and his career is launched.
And right so after that. So this random act of, yeah, we'll give you a couple thousand dollars.
Second choice.
If the budget goes up, you'll get a percentage. It's one in a million. It's like winning a lottery. You're most likely it's never going to get made. You're going to make zero money and the guy becomes a millionaire, takes his career off.
Right. There's a bunch of people that won the lottery. They paid Sean a ton of dough. And, you know, I think it made Christoph a big star. And he got a lot of money. I got nothing. I got no money.
Or residuals. You got residuals.
Yeah. Nope. Didn't get residuals because it was under a BAFTA contract.
Oh, my God. And you're like a major character. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Oh, those son of a bees.
That's okay. I mean, you know, it was fun to do. I didn't want to do any more after that anyway. So, you know, those producers were not fun to work for.
Yeah, it sounds like you went through hell. You probably did that stunt at the end when you fell 10 stories. They probably made you do that for nothing.
Yeah, they put me in the rig and did a fan descender.
Hey, real quick.
But I made some good friends. Made some good friends on it.
Yeah. Who's your closest celebrity friend? Who's your, like, the one friend that you still... Because you have one guy
you're
who
happens... Michael?
It's me.
You're my best celebrity friend.
I bet you don't hang out with a lot of celebrities.
No, I don't. I don't really know any celebrities.
You never hung out with Tim Robbins or Morgan Freeman after Shawshank? You never
always happy to see them. I don't think Morgan recognizes me anymore, but always happy to see Tim. I saw Tim recently. his son had done a film, and it was at Austin Film Festival. I saw him, so it was good to see him. I play ice hockey with him. He's always down at Actors Gang. Always doing something down there at that theater.
He's really sweet. He's just so soft spoken. Has he always been so soft spoken?
Yeah.
He's just this guy, you know. Just hey, man, how you doing? It's all right. All right, hey, this has been incredible, and I hope you had fun. This is real quick, my Patreons who are amazing. They support the podcast. It's called Shit Talking with Clancy Brown. This is rapid fire, so you just answer them. Steph A., is there a character you've always wanted to voice but never got the chance to voice?
A character that I've always wanted to, I don't know. The next one? I don't know.
I don't know. There's got to be a character we're not thinking of. What if there was a character like... they're doing a Shining video game and they want Jack Nicholson voice, but someone to play Jack Nicholson.
There you go. Yeah.
But this is another question. Emily S., what's been your favorite role to perform? I'm guessing you're going to say all of them. Come on.
No, not all of them. Not all of them. I really like this Montgomery Dart guy.
Montgomery Dart, Mortuary Collector.
The Mortuary Collection. He's a fun character. He's a fun dude.
Yeah, you chomped up, ate some scenery, let's just say.
Yeah, we were going greedy.
Just like certain looks at the door when you're looking out there and the angles and then your eyes as the door is closing. Just shit like that. I was like, oh, yeah, he's enjoying this, man.
Great fun. Yeah, chewing it up.
Danny, amazing guest, loves Clancy Brown. Any stories from Buckaroo Banzai? Did he realize it was going to be one of the all-time great cult films?
No, didn't realize it was going to be an all-time great cult film. But it is kind of the bar for me. It's like, it was maybe my first movie. I think it might have been my first movie after I moved out to Los Angeles. And I read the script and I had no idea what was going on, but it was so much fun to read. The whole time of that shoot, I was just laughing and giggling and just, you know, I got this imposter complex anyway. And there I am with, you know, Goldblum and Peter and Lithgow and all these guys. So I'm, you know, I just the luckiest guy on earth. I think, what am I doing here? I have no idea. Pepe Serna, for crying out loud. You know, what am I doing here? And my favorite moment of that was shooting a scene in a bus and Peter and Ellen Barkin are having this intense conversation in the front and all the Hong Kong Cavaliers are kind of in the back of the bus. And Jeff kind of leans out in the middle, into the aisle, and he looks at me and he goes, come here, just watch me doing this the whole time. And he leans out into the aisle and he's doing this little rope trick. And Rawhide is my character is just like completely focused on this rope trick that he's doing. And he starts doing that. And finally, Richter, the director, says, Jeff, stop doing that. Clancy, stop doing that. And he says, what? We're just, you know, livening up the background here. We're just showing, you know, just having a, you know, character life.
You sound like Goldblum.
And he says, you're pulling too much focus. And he just like looks at me and winks. And he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. Jeff was the king of pulling focus with no effort at all. He pulls all the focus. And it was the start of a great friendship between him and Peter and stuff. But I've always gotten a big kick at it.
That's awesome.
Jeff and I used to do this routine. He picked on me because I was so dumb. He included me because I was so dumb. He would say, I'm going to go up to the prop master and I'm going to ask him a question. Then I'm going to turn to you and I'm going to say a bunch of nonsense. But before I say nonsense, I'm going to say maha, and then you say yaha, and then I'll say a bunch of nonsense and you repeat that nonsense back to me and then I'll talk to you. So I had no idea what he was doing, but what, of course, anybody that knows anything is that Maha Yaha is the Three Stooges routine that Mo and Curly did after Curly had his stroke. He would ask a question of somebody, of Larry or whatever, and he would turn to Curly and say Maha, and Ma and Curly. Stroked out, Curly would go, yaha. he was Republican, shy. And Curly would go, ah, but did you get the benefit of shy? And then he would turn back and he would answer the question for somebody else.
Oh,
and we did
God.
This routine all throughout the shoot. And it was only at the end that I realized that it was a Three Stooges routine. Goldblum is such a blast to work
with.
See,
the thing, it's amazing because I had so much fun. I did this one movie and it bombed. It became sort of a cult. And this is the most fun I ever had in a movie. Like that's what right. I always wanted to do. So those are the moments where it's just like you're enjoying. You're like, this is why I'm here. And it'd be icing on the cake if it was a hit, but it wasn't. Maya P says, are there any roles you've done that you wish had gone longer or hope to play again one day?
That one, the Buckaroo Banzai, for sure. you know, that one, and maybe this, we'll see, maybe Montgomery Dark, we'll see if that even happens. I'm not sure.
I could see it's a cool anthology. It can keep going, you know, it could go to the past, you know. Hey, let me ask you this. Are you still doing The Flash, the series?
No. I haven't done that in a while.
When was the last time you did that?
A couple of years ago. I think it was the Gorilla Grodd. And Gorilla Grodd took over Eiling. And I hadn't done it since.
Did you like it? Did you like your experience in The Flash?
Yeah, that was an interesting thing. When I first did it, it hadn't aired yet. And so it wasn't anything yet. And everybody was, you know, working hard and really nervous and all the rest of that stuff. And then when I went up and did it again, it had aired and it was a big hit. And, you know, suddenly everybody was sort of more into their social media and their appointments and all the rest of that stuff. And so, yeah, it wasn't as much fun. It was a different set. Success makes it a different place. You know, it was a different vibe to it.
Yeah.
It's still a good show. I think it's still a good show, but
yeah,
it was a different vibe.
You know, it had to be more enjoyable to work in the, you know, 70s, 80s, even the 90s before all the phones and everything. Not to sound age us, but like there's a certain simplicity and also it was more intimate where you didn't have anything to do but be together and talk and experience life together. I think that now everybody's so distracted. Do you feel that when you're on sets today where it's not as present, people aren't, it's not as fun?
Yeah, I don't know if I go. It's different, you know, for sure. DQ used to talk about Dennis used to say, you know, we had so much fun on Long Riders. We were all hanging out together, and it's just, you know, nobody hangs out anymore. We were talking about this as we were hanging out in some bar, you know, as we were actually right. socializing,
right.
But you know, lamenting that a couple of old guys going, hey, nobody friendly anymore, nobody hangs out anymore, hey. You know, but. So I guess that's something, but it's just different now. You know, people go to their caves a little quicker.
Right.
You know, we also socialize. You know, I did this a season of this thing called Emergence last year, and we hung out. You know, Allison Tolman and everybody. We sort of palled around a bit.
I love it. Well, hey, this has been awesome. Did you have fun?
Yeah, did you have fun?
Yeah, man. You're easy to talk to.
You like my turtle?
I love the turtle. How long have you had the turtle curtain?
I don't know. They're not making them anymore. It's from this woolen mill called Faribault Woolen Mills, and they would have they had this Native American collection that they would do, and that's from that. I love that thing.
All right, dude. Much
yeah,
love.
Yeah,
I love this. I'm gonna harass you because we're gonna hang out when this is over.
All right. Fair enough.
All right. I'll see you later. Thanks again, man.
All right. Thanks, pal.
He's a family guy. He's a private guy. And it was hard to get him in the studio. Well, he didn't come in the studio. We Zoomed. But it was hard to get him to Zoom.
Yeah.
And hearing those stories when he's like, they're going to fire me. I think they got the wrong guy for Shawshank Redemption and things like that. And it's how I always feel like, oh, they're going to hear me in the table read. They're going to fire me. Oops, I'm not fired yet. They're going to watch me and I'm ugly and they're going to, you mm-hmm. always think these things.
And he thought that the entire way through the shooting of the movie.
And he's working with these geniuses.
I like that he got married the day after that rooftop scene. I thought that was a fun story.
Oh yeah. After he was so mean to our friend, Tim Robbins.
He was so mean. He almost threw him off a roof. And then the next day he exchanged vows with the love of his life.
Oh man.
I remember the first day when Andy came into Shawshank.
Well, I think I let me try to get it.
I remember the first day. Andy Dufresne came into Shawshank. Was that better?
I'm going to close my eyes and not look at you.
Let me see here. I remember the first day when Andy Dufresne came into Shawshank.
It's good.
Not bad?
That's pretty good.
Okay. Third try was a little better. You guys let me know what you think, please. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. That was for you. Again, make sure you subscribe, write a review. And now it is time before we go to read off the patrons. Top patrons. Here we go. Ryan, I'm not going to ask you. I'm not going to put you on the spot because, you know, I'm a little brain dead after these holidays.
I appreciate it. Me too.
I'm foggy. Here we go. Nancy D, Leah S, Trisha F, Sarah V, Little Lisa, Yukiko, Jill E, Brian H, Lauren G, Nico P, Robin S, Jerry W, Emily K, Robert I, Jason W, Stephen J, Kristen K, Amelia O, Allison L, Jess J, Lucas M, Raj C, Joshua D, Emily S, CJP, Samantha M, Jennifer N, Jackie P, Stacy L, Carly H, Jennifer S, Janelle B, Carrie B. I feel really tired today. Tabitha 272, not to be confused with.
Tabitha 273.
Ashley Ryan, Kimberly E, Crystal H, Mike E, Marissa N, Jack S. It's Jack S. It's Jack Slater. Ramira, Beth B, Santiago M, Sarah F, Chad W, Leanne P, Roshan. Ray A, Maya P, Maddie S, Tiffany I, Kendrick F, Ashley E, Margie M, Shannon D, Matt W, Belinda N, Kevin V, James R, Chris H, Anusha W,
Osborne H,
Gabby M, Amy C, easy as it. Sorry. Dave H, Samantha S, Spider-Man.
Chase.
That's correct. Sheila.
G-E-G.
G, correct. Ray H, Alyssa C, Tabitha T, Misha H, Debbie. What's up, Debbie? Tom N, Natalie 622, not to be confused with.
Natalie 623.
Correct. Allie B, Suzanne B, Henry S, Katie F, Daniela V, Liliana A, Joseph C, Michelle K, Maddie Wags, Marcus W, Hannah B, Michael S, Luke H, John S, and Rob D. A lot of patrons. Couldn't do it without you. Love you. Stay with me. Don't go anywhere. I need you. I need you. Like the winter needs the spring, like the summer needs the rain. I need you.
This all started on the game.
You know that's America.
That's one of my dad loves America. We play that song. Dude, it was one of the first songs he ever taught me on guitar.
That's one. I need you like the wind. Oh, let's go. I need you like the winter needs a. What does it start out with? Winter needs a spring.
We used to laugh.
We used to cry. We used to bow our heads and wonder why. Now you're gone. I guess I'll carry on.
I know what the chords are better than I know what the words are.
You got to teach me that song. All right, we're embarrassing ourselves. Or I'm embarrassing myself. Anyway, thank you guys for listening. Thank you for a great year, even though it's been a hard year. But we got through it. We're getting through it. We have a glorious year coming to us. Stay with it. Not just with this podcast. Stay with it. Game plan is to always find the good in life. And no matter how bad it gets, there's going to be a light. There's going to be fun moments. There's going to be a good time. You just have to keep pushing, man. I love you all. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting this podcast. Thank you for allowing me to be inside of you.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.